Welcome back to another edition of Summer is Coming. I'm your host, Tiny Grimes, and I'm joined this week by a new guest host, John Bruno. Welcome to the show, John. John. Oh,
sorry, he couldn't make it. So I'm just going to have to sub in for him. It's Dark Notch again.
Or as we call him, Regular Old John.
Regular Old John.
Welcome back to the show, Regular Old John. So, John, since there's a lot of regionals by you, and you're apparently unmarried because you go to them all, were you at a regional recently?
Yeah, last weekend, which was a day ago, I played in the Ottawa Regional, and the weekend before that, I played in the Laval, Quebec Regional.
So I'm going to guess, since you always win your regionals, that you won your regional. But I do want to say, I've said many times that you have this awful meta and you just wreck everyone. And I just want to say, I'm joking. I don't know anyone in Dark Naj's meta, of course. I don't know anyone really in anyone's meta other than the main players. So when I say things like that, I'm just giving Dark Naj a hard time because he has like 27 regional wins and I have zero. That's all it is.
I've only got 4 regional wins now.
Oh, okay. Fine. Only 4. Poor guy.
Yeah. Two this year, which means I did win both my regionals. Now, the Ottawa regional was pretty small. We ended up with only 7 or 8 players. And I think the main reason for that was there was a crazy huge price tag on the event.
Oh, that's not good.
It's basically $60 if you wanted to play.
I might have passed on that one.
Yeah.
I do have a question for you. How many of these events was John Bruno at again?
None of them.
Okay. We can move on then.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not trying to pretend there's any Brunos in my meta, but, I mean, how many metas have a Bruno?
Exactly.
3 in total, maybe?
And ours has 2. No, I'm just kidding. No one's on the level of John Bruno. So, what did you run at this regional?
The Ottawa regional, I ran a Lannister the Long Voyage deck. And it was more of a deck saying, I just wanted to show the strength of the Long Voyage. You know, when I came there, some of the people said, you really think it's that strong? Because one of the stronger players was running Stark Maesters, and he was the actual person I ended up competing with. And he said, well, I'll switch to my Greyjoy Long Voyage deck if you really think it's that strong. I've been going back and forth. I can't decide whether to play my Stark Maesters, which I'm more familiar with, and I think it's a strong deck, or this Greyjoy the Long Voyage deck that I've had for, you know, 3 weeks or something. So in the end, he decided to go with his Stark Maesters, and he did really well. He placed 2nd in the event. But there was definitely a look that, wow, yeah, the Long Voyage does have some strength. It's a good agenda.
With such a small field, did you guys have a cut, or did you just do Swiss?
We chose to do 3 rounds of Swiss and then a cut to top 4 so that there'd be more games, so that everyone would that came out. Because we had one person that drove in from Montreal. The rest of the that was the only out-of-towner, basically. And actually, 3 people that normally play with us didn't even show up to this just because of the cost, which was really too bad. So, but because the out-of-towner came, we weren't going to just play 3 games and then call it. So we decided to do 3 people basically can no longer play, and then the cut to top 4.
Yeah, I'd like a cut to top 4, even with a small field. I just feel like that's when you get the real games. For me, the Swiss rounds are just all about making the top 4.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what we ended up doing. It was a really fun tournament. Laval was way more interesting from the perspective that I was going into a meta that I knew absolutely nothing about. Mm-hmm. In fact, going down there, I brought 3 decks, and I didn't even know what I was going to play until the day of the tournament. Like, at 10 minutes before the tournament, I asked someone to randomly pick my deck.
And that doesn't sound like a smart move.
I felt that all 3 were strong decks. One of them was a Targaryen Burn that I was really worried about, these heavy aggro, the Long Voyage decks, because it's just the big characters were hard to burn, and they could put out so many characters, I couldn't control them with burn. But the other 2 I thought would do well. And actually the one that the person picked ended up being Barrow Wildlings. And I find the new Wildlings to be really resilient, and that they can easily adapt to almost any other deck. So it starts to come down to, you know, if I can play this well, I can probably do okay. And they ended up doing very well for me.
Yeah, it seems like in an aggro meta, they are aggro, but at the same time, they're almost anti-aggro because aggro decks have a hard time pushing through those challenges against them because they're so big. They all have stealth. What I've always found is that the deck just dies to a well-timed Valor. How did that not become a problem for you?
Well, like, why does it normally die to a well-timed Valor? In my opinion, it's because they don't have any card draw normally, right?
Yes, they've correct.
Pooped out their hand, they lose Valor or something. But now, with Negotiants at the Great Sept and the ability to copy that, it kind of fills in this draw hole for them. So someone Vowels, they fill back up their hand, they puke out a bunch of Wildlings. And my version of the deck played a larger amount of locations than a normal version. I had like 14 or 15 locations. Almost none of them were discard locations, so I was able to easily refill the board in later game scenarios because of that.
Interesting. So basically, because you could do City of Spiders to copy Negotiations, you're getting two new hands later in the game. Were you even running Val?
No, I wasn't running Val, so I would never Val myself.
I'm sorry, not Valor, the card Val that gives you card draw.
Oh, yes, I was. Yeah, that was my restricted. Yeah, so I still had that card draw, but then I used Negotiations at the Great Sept, and I found that I didn't even need to copy it in playtesting, that the single one was enough to refill my hand in late game and come back.
Were you even running City of Spiders then, or did you just run the one copy?
Just the one copy, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I found in all my Long Voyage decks, I get all excited. Oh my goodness, I can copy this. I find that the copy is just really not all that necessary.
Yeah, for sure. So would you like to hear a little bit of the Quebec meta? Because I think this is a meta that most AGOT players have never heard of. You know, they always say the Canadian metas, but they're very distinct metas, and it was really interesting going to Quebec to play and meeting, you know, all these new guys, basically.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about what you saw up there.
There was a lot of Long Voyage, obviously, but there was also some House of Dreams. So there was a House of Dream Bear Island primarily, but of course he had other locations for when he matched against Stark that was made the cut at 7th seed after Swiss. And there was Martel No Agenda, which I've seen around a bit, but it hasn't been really strong. And then there was a Lannister Power Behind the Throne deck, whose only loss was actually against my Wildling deck in the final. And I played this deck in Swiss, and the pilot, Adam, has some interesting, I won't say that they're combos, but his approach to piloting the deck was different than I've seen in a lot of other players. He had one of two opening sequences. He would sometimes open with Fear of Winter and do the standard Lannister, you know, Power Behind the Throne, Fear of Winter, and smash someone's hand down to nothing. Mm-hmm. But he also tended to use some events pre-plot, and then use rule by decree to have people discard their cards. And when I talked to him, he was saying that that wasn't really because he was trying to, oh, he really wanted you to lose three cards. He wanted to turn Ash on as soon as possible in his games so that if he could get you to discard down and then get through another intrigue challenge, you know, on first turn, he might have Ash on almost immediately. And that would just steamroll his rush capabilities so quickly. Like, he'd be able to come so fast. A lot of his games he won turn two. And he was just destroying. The first game I played against him, he won on turn two against the Wildlings. And I just felt like I was Cersei and he was Jaime, and he just really gave it to me that game. It was bad.
And yeah. How did that happen? Were you just not able to get the big guys out, or did he just wipe out your hand too fast?
You know, he much and more'd pre-plot. So I was up to 8 cards, and then he ruled by decree, getting me to drop down. I dropped my first snow because, you know, in general, Lannister has a lot of weenies, but he got both Asha, Cersei, and another 3-coster out, and then they proceeded to basically gather so much power, I couldn't do much. And then by turn two, he played, you know, Power Blood, so I couldn't kill them, and then just won.
Right, so it sounds to me like that's the perfect case of if you play a deck in a somewhat unusual manner, you can often surprise someone. And that's the difference between Swiss rounds and the cut. So now we go fast forward to the cut, where you know what he's trying to do. What were you able to do differently to adapt to this approach that allowed you to win? Or was it just simply he didn't draw what he needed?
I wouldn't say he didn't draw what he needed. I got some strong int icons. I knew to mulligan early, of course, and I did to get make sure I had a strong int presence. He also didn't do any pre-plot shenanigans. He feared a winter, and I was able to hold off the military, and then after from that point on, I had some direct kill. I was able to kill Cersei, and that was it. So the Wildling deck runs 9 direct kill or kill-like events.
And
so
what are these events?
I got 3 Die by the Sword, I got 3 Terminal Schemes, and I got 3 Seductive Promises in the deck.
Very nice.
So it has a lot of direct control, and that was basically my plan against a lot of the Barrow Rush, was that I would just kill those key characters on turn 1, usually with intrigue attacks, which they weren't expecting Wildlings to be killing their guys with Terminal Schemes, and that would allow me to basically control the rush. I also had some events, plot choices for Greyjoy that said, you know, he cannot be saved. And this actually really helped me against the Lannister player when he tried to Val with his duped Asha out, and I played that, basically killing her and sealing the game for myself.
What was it that you played?
Assault on King's Landing.
Ah, okay.
So characters and locations cannot be saved.
Sure. So you were able to time that with his Valor.
Yeah.
Was it a pretty well-telegraphed Valor, like you were just crushing him and he didn't have much choice?
No, but I knew that if he didn't Valor there, I would probably win within that turn or next. So it was not super telegraphed, but I knew he was a good enough player to know that he had to Valor, so I played it.
Right. Gotcha. So we're going to call that telegraphed.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, there's 2 telegraphing Valors, right? There's like doing things like letting all your guys die because you don't care because you're going to Valor. And then there's the, if he doesn't Valor here, he loses anyway, so I might as well play my anti-Valor card.
Right. That was more of the way. If he doesn't Valor here, he will lose. If I don't play this and he still has Asha, he may win. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, congratulations. So that adds to your pile of trophies. Do you have like a special room that you pile all your trophies? Do you make your children carry them around the house? I mean, how do you handle that?
4 trophies isn't that many. I think Eric Butzloff once won 3 regionals in the same season. I think that's the current the record. So I think my 4 trophies are nothing to his, however many.
I think I'm on pace to break that this season. Oh, wait, you didn't say lose 3 regionals, right? Oh, okay. No, I probably won't break that then. Before we continue, I'd like to announce that I will be at a regional coming up pretty quick at Kublai Khan, which is held in Northern California on Memorial Day weekend, May 24th to 27th. It's basically a 4-day awesome event. It's going to be Friday Star Wars, where I'll be there in that event. Saturday will be Game of Thrones I'll be playing. Sunday will be Netrunner, which I don't play, but a lot of other people do. So if you want to come out and meet John Bruno and meet myself and Dark Naj, I'm sure will be there, and any of the other members from our meta and NorCal, come on out. It's going to be a great time. It's one of the biggest gaming conventions outside of Gen Con, so I'm really excited to be going this year. And if you can't afford to come, if you're willing to volunteer 8 hours of your time, you can get your admission to the event comped. So that is pretty amazing.
It does sound like a pretty good event, Tiny. I'm sure you guys will have a blast at it.
Yeah, it's going to be in Burlingame, California. And if you want to check their website, it's a really complicated address, www.kublaikhan.com. So hopefully I'll see you there. Dark Naj, are you going to be there?
I wish I could make it, but you know, the $600 flight would probably be a little too expensive for me.
You know what? If you come, I'll chip in $20 for your flight.
Wow, man. That's so kind of you.
Hey, that's generosity right there.
I'd like to talk about a few more decks that I ran into at the Laval Regional that I thought was interesting takes on old concepts.
Sure.
I ran into a Stark Siege that was running pretty standard stuff. So, you know, your epic battles and everything. But the thing that was I found different was his use of Shadow Cats. Now, a lot of Stark Siege has moved away from Shadow Cats, and they started using, you know, Sirio and basically not Shadow Cats, but other types of smaller one-cost, zero-cost characters. The
right.
Shadow Cats were extremely useful for this guy all through the tournament because First Snow was so prevalent. So he'd play his three epic battles. Someone would play First Snow. And he'd have, you know, two cards in Shadows, we'll say. Or maybe he'd put another card into Shadow. And if he didn't happen to draw that serial, he was still able to, you know, do his first challenge, get a bunch of his characters returned to his hand because he didn't get another Cavalry Flank or something. And then later, bring those Shadow Cats out of Shadows to get those extra challenges in during the epic phases for Stealth. And it wasn't something that I really thought of until I saw the prevalence of First Snow, and I started to think, hey, that's a really great idea. And he did quite well. He ended up playing me twice. The very first game was during the Swiss, and I think I should have actually lost versus him. But I made a mistake. I basically tried to use my skin changer outside of the challenges phase. And as we know, skin changers are all our challenges only, but neither he nor I caught it.
Ooh.
And it slightly changed the game because he still managed to wipe my board after his second epic phase. And then I came back from that point. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing was he ended up being the fifth seed while I was the sixth, or he was the sixth seed and I was the fourth seed, so we ended up playing. And if I had lost that game, it would have reversed. And he would have been the fourth seed and I would have been the sixth seed. So we would have ended up playing the exact same match regardless.
That's interesting.
So I didn't feel bad about the mistake, because when we went out for dinner with some of the guys from Laval, someone mentioned, did I see this happen? We were like, yeah. And he's like, you know, that's challenges only. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Right, I'm an idiot. Okay, good.
And they're like, you have a podcast and know those kind of things, right, Cheater McGee?
But then when I went back, I actually talked to the judge, and he mentioned, he said, no, you guys would have played either way. So, I mean, it's not going to make a difference. So it's like, okay, well, if it's not going to make a difference, I don't care. I don't feel bad now, you know? So
that's really interesting. It just seems to me like Shadow Cats are so overcosted. I really can't see myself putting them in. It seems like I'd rather put in other Shadow cards instead of Shadow Cats.
It's the stealth they got, right? It's that little bit of stealth to push through it. I had the exact same opinion as you, Tiny. It's when I saw them being used, I was like, wow, this is good. I'm really surprised it's good, but it's good from what I'm seeing. And I heard people complaining about it, and it's something that everyone's like, who plays with Shadow Cats?
Right. So, did he have a way of putting them back into Shadows with any sort of plots to put cards back in his hand or anything like that?
Nope, he didn't put them back into Shadows. He just used them that one or... But if he had one or two, it's that extra one or two, you know, military challenges he'd get through in his epic phases. Because he always could start the game with four or five epic battles out.
Mm.
It was quite impressive.
I guess that's pretty reasonable then, because if you have all those Shadow Cats and Shadows, you're right. So if they play First Snow, they're unaffected. If instead of playing three Shadow Cats, you played one Cavalry Flank and one other guy, those are more easily controlled than Shadows cards.
This was it. So the kneeling, you know, Lannister would kneel out his Cavalry Flank, and then he'd be like, well. Or the worst would be he would get, you know, Sirio out, and he would come at someone, and they would do, like, you know, the only game that matters. And that one military challenge would be stopped. They'd be like, well, that's it for the rest of his epics. But no,
right.
Next epic, a Shadow Cat comes out. And, you know, it might just be that one extra challenge, but it's a two-claimer. And it just makes so much difference in controlling your opponent's board.
Yeah, and it's two-claim, and it's probably going to be three-power if you are stealthing with C.
Exactly, yeah. So it just, it added so much to the rush. So it was surprisingly good in the deck, and I thought it was worth mentioning that, you know, in it wasn't something like a guy just threw it together. He explained the reasoning behind the Shadow Cats as that to me, and I was like, okay, wow, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I definitely never would have thought to add Shadow Cat to Stark Siege because of the reason that Stark has a million ultra-efficient two-cost characters, but it is a decent point that First No and all the control out there, Shadow Cats can't be controlled, or at least not as easily.
It's almost impossible to control them in the epic phase unless you have
an end time. Yeah, it's true, because you can't do if you're a first player.
Yeah,
they can't even kneel them because there's no action window.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really interesting.
They definitely get into the challenge in that epic phase, so it's pretty nice. There was a newer player I want to give a little props to. He was running a Bera Knights of the Realm. It was extremely fast. It was efficient. He was 4th seed. He did well in the tournament overall. He won his first match in the top eight and got fourth overall in the tournament. And he's only been playing for a few months, but he knew all the timing charts. He always took his time. He was obviously thinking through all the rules. I didn't see him make any play mistakes. And his deck was really well put together. It was a heavy Noble Rush with a Knight sub theme. Just enough Knights to make sure he had the draw. And, you know, he was running the Edric that could prevent events on his Noble characters and stuff like that. So it was a well put together deck.
Sounds interesting. Well, good for him. It's nice to see newer players who can do that. We have a newer player in our meta. She's a woman who's joined the meta, and she's very, very good at not missing triggers and knowing the windows and things like that. Like, she hasn't quite gotten to the point where she's at the elite play skill level. But I feel like being able to track everything on the board is that first step to becoming really good.
Yeah. I mean, I played him, the second last round. And the only reason I won is because I got Breen out and I could actually start using my events to kill his guys finally.
Yeah, Brienne is amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in the two regionals you went to, did you see Long Voyage doing pretty well?
There was a lot of Long Voyage at the Laval regional, but a lot of the Long Voyage were Intrigue Light, and because of that, the Power Behind the Throne decks just ripped big holes in them. And like I said, Adam was just owning people. He was undefeated through the Swiss, and his matches were super quick. You know, he played, I think, a Greyjoy Long Voyage, a Stark Long Voyage. I'm not 100% sure because I didn't watch his games, but I know that those people were floating around. I heard them complaining, so I don't know if it was him or the other Lannister Power Behind the Throne player that demolished them. But basically, Intrigue Light and these guys rush in one or two turns. You can't kill their Noble Crested characters, and it's just really easy wins.
Yeah.
So I think that did a lot to reduce their placement in the top eight. They were still in the top eight, mind you, but there was probably four or five Long Voyage decks, and only two of them, I believe, made it to the top eight.
Interesting. Yeah, we just had an event in NorCal that people probably saw that someone I hadn't heard of before was able to win with a Long Voyage deck. Now, that doesn't mean that player's not a great player, but he was able to beat a pretty good field of people that I know well, that I know our top players, such as John Kraus and John Bruno. So it seems like Long Voyage is still having quite a bit of success here as we approach, should we say, the midpoint of the regional season?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if I didn't think it was strong, I wouldn't have ran it in the Ottawa regional, and it worked out great for me. Lannister was a nice house to play it out of. Lots of Neil, lots of control events, and a lot of people I just went in with the approach, I'm going to draw more cards than them. I just need to stall for my card advantage.
Mm.
So I'd go 9-10 plots with people, and I just hold them off, grind them down, and then sooner or later my card advantage would kick in, and then I would win.
Makes sense. So, let's talk about Long Voyage then. What do you think is the best house to run it out of?
Honestly, I think that it might be Targ.
Interesting. Are you thinking of the build my friend Chris was running, or just generally speaking, Targ, it seems like the best way to run it?
I think more along the Tulsa build. The Dragon build is one of the stronger Long Voyage decks, I think, out there, in my opinion.
Yeah. And is it because it's fast and big, or?
It's fast, it's got stealth, it's got a little bit of spot control. There's lots of standing in it. So, I mean, when you combine all those things, you have these you know, big scary dragons that also have these cool abilities that you can trigger. It's well-rounded. And I think well-rounded decks in this environment, plus it has the same type of aggro, is better than just a pure aggro deck.
Yeah, I agree. I have a Baratheon, so we can segue to Baratheon. I have a Baratheon deck, and the problem I'm having with it is it's a great offensive deck. But what it's missing is defense. Because what I feel like is you have so many slots for these cards you can't put out on setup, and if you are using them for offense, for getting vigilant, things like that, you're giving up on defense. And so I've been winning a lot of games with it, but I just don't feel comfortable. It always feels tenuous. Like at any moment, it could fall apart by my opponent doing something. I have no great way to handle what they're doing. I'm just trying to do what I'm doing better than what they're doing.
Right. I mean, you can fill in some of those holes by running Edric so that you can, you know, prevent the direct kill on your noble characters and stuff. But yeah, it definitely has that feeling like I was running the only game that matters in my Lannister, the Long Voyage deck, to fight Baratheon. And whenever I came up with Baratheon and had that my card in my hand, it was like, well, there goes, you know, basically a whole challenge phase. You come in with your power challenge, you figure your vigilance is going to stand your guy. Now, none of these guys count their strength. You don't win. And you could just see the Baratheon's player face go, wow, that's like a Burning on the Sound versus Baera.
Yeah, that card is really, really strong right now. Yeah. I was playing someone the other night who was running a Lannister Long Voyage on Octagon against my Greyjoy deck, and I had been burned already in a different game by that card. And so what a better player does is he remembers that, right? And he says, okay, this is in the meta now. It's a good card. So I had a choice between attacking with Baylor Blacktide and with my one lone Carrion Bird. And so I decide I'm going to do the one lone Carrion Bird. I don't see anything he can do, some trick to let him block it. But in case he does, I'm still going to do it anyway so that I can have Baylor Blacktide left back with the Finger Dance in hand. And sure enough, he had it, was able to Finger Dance it, and so it went from nothing bad happening to his board clearing. So it is a really strong card you got to be ready for.
Yeah, for sure.
So what about Lannister? Do you think Lannister is one of the top houses for Long Voyage?
For Long Voyage, yeah. I think it's a good house. Honestly, I think every house can pull together a Long Voyage deck and be pretty effective. Greyjoy does it by having a ton of saves and just basically out slugfesting whoever they're fighting. Lannister does it by having all these little control elements, especially for the long game. As they get more locations out that can control their games, you know, now after the reset, they're going to have a big advantage. And, you know, Targ does it with fast rushing dragons. Baera does it with, again, Noble Rush. You know, I see a lot of strength in every house if they want to run the Long Voyage. How about you, Tiny?
Yeah, I agree. The one house I'm not as sold on is Lannister. I feel like they can have so much draw that this Long Voyage really helped them that much, especially since negotiations doesn't work with it as well. Like when I played my opponent, he had 12 cards in his hand, and I played negotiations, and he was not able to use it because he has a 12-card hand. So, I mean, a 12-card hand isn't a negative, but it just doesn't seem to synergize quite as well with things like negotiations at the Sept.
I loved my negotiations. I considered actually copying it. This was one of the few decks that I thought, Shadows and Spiders would really be helpful so I could copy my negotiations because I emptied my hand so quickly. I played with basically a ton of gold production. 9 gold weenies. I was counting 10, 12 gold in a lot of my games. So I would be able to dump my hand, and I was playing a heavy character base too.
Right.
I'd be able to dump my hand, like drawing, I'd have a gold tooth mine out, I'd have Toman, I'd be draw capped, and I'd be saying, damn, I wish I could get more cards because I can just spew forth. Just fill the board. So, I easily played by complete hand every round. And I would draw cap very quickly. So, you know, Lannister has great draw, but, you know, what's better than drawing 3 cards every round? Trying 5.
Yeah.
So,
sure.
With the Gold Tooth Mines and Toman, I found that I could easily get to 4 cards a turn and 5, and I always used my Great Sept, Negotiations of the Great Sept, and I always emptied my hand afterwards.
All right. Well, interesting. So. I have not found myself being able to do that. I have a build of almost every house Long Voyage now just because that's how I am. I'm going to try them all out. I haven't tried Martell yet, and I haven't tried Targ yet. But yeah, my Long Voyage deck for Lannister, it just feels like Lannister doesn't have as many characters that pack a lot of punch. And so with that being the case, with Long Voyage, it felt like the deck that was harder to round out with good characters. Like, yeah, I got to play more gold weenies, and I liked that. But the character pool itself, I just wasn't as happy with it.
I think you have to start looking at the clansmen to be a little bit more aggressive. Stuff like Black Ears, you know, that 4-cost deadly that you can discard cards to bring people out of challenges if you want, was just money. you know, Jalabar Xo, who makes characters not claim power for renown.
That's just cruel.
The non-standing Jamie, great character. I mean, a lot of the clansmen, you know, even little things like painted dogs, or I had a lot of deadly in, and I ran. I actually paid for King Joffrey's guard one time with the gold.
Wow.
Just straight up. And I also ran things like gold cloaks, and I know people don't like them because they're allies, but I have so many allies in this deck that I get the dissensions out early, so I don't have to worry about them discarding things like gold cloak or brawn or stuff, because they're going to kill one of my gold weenies or, you know, something else, because there's just so many targets for dissension, and there's not as much dissension in the meta.
Yeah, that's true. It's just funny to hear you say that you played brawn. Brawn's one of those guys that almost every new player, when they see brawn, they're like, oh my god, this card's amazing. And then I always have to say, no, that card's terrible. So it's fun to see you saying, nope, he's amazing.
He's back to amazing just because of the meta. I mean, once the meta goes back to more ally hate, there's no way I'm paying 4 gold for that guy. But
yep.
He was a wall of doom. People were like, oh, I can't challenge you. You got Braun. You're going to throw him plus that guy that can take guys out of my challenge, and then you're going to kill my best character every time. Or Watchful Servant, someone out of the challenge and kill my best character. And I was like, yep, that's exactly what I'm going to do.
That's pretty scary. A Tricon, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, and then they play Jorah Mormont, and you cry for a while.
Yep, for sure.
But not too long, because you get 8 gold every turn, right?
Yeah, and I'll just dump another 4 characters out.
I think for me so far, I'm liking Greyjoy best out of Long Voyage, because I feel like it can walk the line the best of having defense and offense simultaneously. You get all those amazing offensive characters, and then you get saves and cancels and things like that to actually take care of what your opponent's trying to do.
Yeah, and then you just wait for a couple of boats so that you can push through challenges easy, and then you're golden.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that it's the best house. I wouldn't make that assertion, but I've been enjoying it. But then again, this might be a surprise to people. Greyjoy is one of my favorite houses, because when I came into the game, it's when it got all those amazing cards, and Asha and Baylor Blacktide and all these great cards that when I look at Greyjoy, it just reminds me of when I started the game, and I still have a fondness for that house. And it's like, it's going to sound really bad, but it's the ultimate noob deck, right? You just throw out a ton of dudes, save them all, and the next turn throw out a ton more. So it's, I don't know, it's just kind of a great deck to just throw out a bunch of characters and win with.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember you played Greyjoy Maesters, I think, in the warm-up tournament at Gen Con.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was my favorite deck.
Yeah. It was your favorite deck, but it wasn't the one you thought could win.
Exactly, and to me, those are different. Just because I like a deck does not mean I will play a deck.
See, unlike me, who must play the deck he enjoys the most.
Yes, and we both lost at that event, so I guess it didn't really matter, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, not the warm-up. We both did really well in the warm-up.
Yeah, we did. I don't remember. How did that work? Was there no cut, and we both tied at 4-0 or something like that?
We tied at 4-0, and then we just played a game afterwards because, you know, we're like that.
Yeah, and that, I don't remember that. I remember going 4-0 in that event.
I believe I won that game.
Pretty sure that didn't happen. Was it on record with a TO? Didn't happen. That's basically an octagon game.
Okay. But the one we played, like, in the tournament was real, right?
That was, but I made the cut and you didn't, so that doesn't matter anyway. Do you like how I'm able to spin all my losses into not mattering? It's a pretty impressive skill that I have.
It's true. I didn't make the cut. I missed it by 1 point, which is not like 1 point in the tournament. I was tied with a bunch of people who had the same number of wins and losses as me, but 1 point in the strength of schedule. Which was just devastating.
You know what would have fixed that if you had gone 5-1 instead of 4-2?
Yeah, it was tough though. Those last games, I mean, Will kind of laughed at me when he played the Iron Throne and basically just totally rained on my parade.
So. Yeah, that's the Bruno tough love that he gives me with the whole, I say, well, I'm not sure how worth it is to go to Worlds if I don't have a bye. And he says, what are you talking about? All you do is you go 5-1 and make the cut. You don't have to worry about it. Buys.
I got a bunch of buys. I mean, I could give you one. I'm not even going to.
Yeah, you know, just send me that card. Call the store back. Tell
no,
them I'm the one
I got the forms.
I'm sure that's all kosher.
No, they gave me the forms.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, yeah. Speaking of cheating, Arkash, offering to cheat, I think you should be pre-disqualified from Worlds.
I wasn't serious.
I believe there was a much-talked-about event over the weekend. I'm not sure if you saw this.
I did. I want to congratulate the organizer of this event. The French National AGOT Championship got 113 players, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty phenomenal.
I wish we could get 113 players around here. You know, the next Quebec Regional looks like shaping up to be 16 or 20 players or something. And I'm excited about that. I'm hoping.
Yeah, that's not bad at all.
Is going to be. They had 16 or 18 last year in New York, so I'll be going to that as well. And I'm hoping to get a similar turnout. Yeah, 113. Wow, that would just be awesome.
And Long Voyage wasn't legal. Oh, the good old days.
I know. So the top of the field looked like it was just covered in black sails and rusted maesters.
Yes, and rusted maesters are really strong. One of the people in Armada right now, Angela, has been piloting them. In the last two tournaments, she made the cut. And I was really excited to see that, because if you've met Angela, she's a very wonderful person. It's nice to see her making some cuts with that really strong deck.
Yeah, it's a great deck. It does have some really evident weaknesses that I see people, like a lot of counters that I see people play. And I don't know if that's because they're so used to the deck type now and they're like, ooh, you got to watch out for this. Make sure you play this counter.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's not something we see winning a lot of tournaments around here.
Yep. To me, I call that a top eight, not winning deck.
Yeah. And I think you're going to see that happen a lot because everyone's got it on their mind for probably the next couple months, and they'll have an answer in their deck if they're wise.
Yep, definitely.
So at this event, I guess there was an issue where a player was accused of cheating. Now, I don't know if cheating happened or not, but it's really sad to hear about a big event like this where something like that tarnishes the event, because it sounded like it was really well organized. The players all seemed to be having a really good time. You know, they were going out drinking and having a good, you know, they're all chummy.
And they had a stream going, which is awesome. I think we all learned from FFG Worlds that having a live stream really brings other people into the orbit of your event and gets everyone excited about it. Yeah, and ironically, that's how this guy was caught cheating, or at least allegedly cheating. It seems as if, and I don't want to make any claims about actual cheating, but it seems as if there were shenanigans with how he was shuffling his deck, which were caught on video, and then he immediately laid down his deck and drew up his cards real quick without offering his opponent a cut. Now, I've actually done that before, where I have not offered my opponent a cut. And it's because we don't do that when we're just playing. And so every now and then, like the first round of a regional or something, I might accidentally make that mistake.
I hardly ever cut my opponent's deck. And actually, at one of my tournaments, someone was, Mike was making a joke basically that I didn't cut and he got a 7-card flop. And then the next game we played, I cut and he got like a 2-card flop. And I was like, oh, so that'll teach you.
Yeah, you might want to cut.
And then this happens, and you know, it just goes to show that I guess you should cut everyone's deck all the time.
Yeah,
just to be sure.
It's really a bit upsetting because we tend to think in the Game of Thrones community, like, because there's less on the line, people are less likely to fall into those moral gray areas, and people are generally nicer. But what I'm a little bit worried about is, because there's less on the line and people are generally nicer, the cheaters just get away with it so much easier, because the expectation is, why the heck would you cheat when there is no prize money? Like, what is the motivation for doing so?
I think there are very few cheaters, if any, in the AGOT community in general. I think it's more of a community about having a good time, playing competitively a game they really enjoy. But I see people at major events sometimes going, it's okay, you can take that back. I mean, I've seen other people say, once the cut, normally, that's the big divide, you know? Yeah. I see after the cut, it's like, too friggin' bad. But, you know, during it, if they feel like they're winning and someone makes a play mistake and it'll make the game more interesting for that other player, I've seen them say, it's okay. You know, go ahead, take that back. Your hand's not off the card or, you know, whatever, and continue on. And I think that's a great sentiment. You know, after the cut, it's all about, you know, competition, and that's healthy, but it's a great community, and I don't think there's a lot of cheaters. So it's really too bad that, you know, there might be that one or two bad apples, and because of that, now I just say, okay, make sure you cut your decks of your opponents. You might be playing that one guy that happens to want to cheat. So.
Yeah, and it's a hard thing. It's like, you think about why would someone cheat at Game of Thrones? You know, it's like, it feels like it's one of two areas. Either for whatever reason, there's become too much at stake for that person. You know, they have their ego too wrapped in the game or some other problem. Or, and this is what I'm worried about, is that some people might have like a baseball mentality. I don't know if you've heard the saying, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, right? So it's like just a part of the game that you try to get away with stuff. And I could just see a certain small percentage of people thinking something like, hey, if I offer you a cut and you don't cut, that's on you, right? That's your mistake. Or if I draw three cards instead of two, you're looking at me. If you're not seeing what I'm doing, that's on you rather than me.
I really hope there's not that.
Yeah, I'm hoping so as well, but I could see some players taking that kind of mentality and justifying it to themselves in that
way. What I'm really scared of now is because there's been all this talk of cheating, that people are going to start to, you know, watch people and start accusing them of it all the time. It is easy to make mistakes in this game.
I agree.
And just because someone, you know, maybe they drew an extra card, maybe they flopped two limited locations, maybe they did X, Y, or Z, I don't think they're trying to cheat you. It was probably an honest mistake. And
kind of like you with that card where you obviously cheated the guy and won the tournament because of it.
Yeah, exactly. Like how I misused my wild lead.
Misused, blatantly cheated. They're pretty interchangeable.
Yeah, I guess, right? So that's a great example, you know. You get wrapped up with an idea of something, and you say, oh, yeah, that I forgot to do X, you know, in this phase. You know, I can just do it now, and it's going to last forever. Or, you know, and you forget a rule, or you get too caught up in the game that you miss something. I think, in general, you should give the benefit of the doubt to people, because I think, in general, there's not a lot of cheaters, but there may be a lot of mistakes. It's a complicated game.
I'm really hoping that is the case. I know firsthand, I've started streaming a lot of my Star Wars LCG games. So anyone out there is interested, on Twitch TV, Tiny Grimes. And I have a bunch of people who watch them. And I chalk it up to the fact that I'm trying to stream and play and talk in the stream and provide Skype commentary during the game. I do all kinds of illegal things and let my opponents do them. Like, certain cards will say, only triggers a character or targets a character, and I'll let my opponent do it to their vehicle. And like, one card I played that said, only during my turn, and I played it during my opponent's turn, or vice versa. And it was totally game-changing. And after the game, someone was like, just so you know, that's illegal. And I was like, oh my goodness, you know, thanks for pointing it out. But I can assure you, I'm not like a blatant cheater who gets caught regularly, because that would be pretty ridiculous on a live stream to be cheating regularly. Like, you would get a pretty quick reputation of, yeah, he wins a lot, but he cheats every game. So mistakes do happen. I think Dark Knight is right there. Don't immediately jump to, oh my goodness, this guy's a cheater. Probably he's not cheating you, and there was just an honest mistake in there.
Yeah, I think unless there's, you know, everyone's saying there's way more evidence of this, that he did it several times, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not going to get into the specifics of the French tournament. But I think in general, I want to tell the community to, you know, just not dismiss this, but in general, don't take it to heart. Just think to yourself, most of these guys are here to have fun, to have some beer with me, and that's where it should end.
Yeah, there's really
not. And I'm sorry, much Trevor.
What's that?
And I'm sorry, Trevor, for misusing my skin changer.
Oh, well, that happens. At least Dark Knight didn't cheat you when it mattered in the final four. Though he would have given the opportunity. All right. Well, from one cheater to another, I think that's going to wrap up this edition of Summer is Coming. So until next week, stay classy, Westeros.